had a standing order during his presidency that documents removed from the Oval Office and taken to his residence were deemed to be declassified the moment he moved them. That claim would not resolve the investigation. Two of the laws referred to in the search warrant executed this week criminalized the taking or concealment of government records, regardless of whether they had anything to do with national security. And laws against taking material with restricted national security information are not dependent on whether the material is technically classified. John Bolton, who served as Donald Trump's third national security adviser over 17 months, said he had never heard of the standing order that Mr. Trump's office claimed to have in place. It is, he said, almost certainly a lie. I was never briefed on any such order, procedure, policy when I came in, John Bolton said, adding that he had never been told of it while he was working there, and had never heard of such a thing after. If he were to say something like that, you would have to memorialize that so that people would know it existed, he said. What's more, he pointed out, secure facilities for viewing sensitive material were constructed at Donald Trump's clubs in Florida and New Jersey, when he often spent weekends as president, meaning that the documents wouldn't need to be declassified. And if they were declassified, John Bolton said, they would be considered subject to public record requests. He continued, when somebody begins to concoct lies like this, it shows a real level of desperation. The claim that the documents held in the Florida residence were declassified also undercut an assertion one of Mr. Trump's lawyers made back in June. In a written declaration, the lawyer's team said all material marked as classified and stored at Mar-a-Lago had been returned to the government. This week, Donald Trump again accused the Justice Department of acting as a tool for his political opponents, a familiar tactic for a former president who had tried repeatedly to politicize the department during his 4 years in office. Describing the FBI as corrupt, Donald Trump suggested that its agents had planted incriminating material at Mar-a-Lago during the search and demanded they return documents that he said were protected by executive privilege. Such accusations of political motivation prompted Attorney General Merrick Garland to defend the FBI's agents during brief remarks earlier this week. Donald Trump's unverified accusations also came as the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security last week issued an intelligence bulletin that warned of an increase in threats against federal law enforcement after a search of Mar-a-Lago, including general calls for a civil war or armed rebellion.
Iran and the technology. In May 1945, a group of experts prepared a base to detonate 100 tons of TNT. They were busy finding an appropriate criterion to measure a huge bomb in Alamogordo, New Mexico. The volume of the explosives should have been so large to simulate the main test. In the middle of all this, the differences of opinion between two groups of scientists over the secretive Manhattan Project grew larger.
This group of scientists who were supposed to change the mid-20th century's fate could not reach an agreement on a certain issue. Most of them were of the opinion that after making an atomic bomb, the United States should put its power on display at night for Japanese envoys in order to make the Japanese emperor surrender by threatening him with the bomb. However, theoretical physicist Edward Teller insisted on testing the atomic bomb on a city to learn about its effects on its population.
The American people in their righteous
The only fight thing that could put an end to the differences was the speech by then U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt for the scientist. It tipped the balance in favor of Teller.
Among other things, and at the climax, he said, "You scientists are blamed for the weapons to be used. But I tell you that if you now won't work on weapons, the freedom of the world will be lost." Now, you know, I had the feeling that Roosevelt was talking to me. I was there when the letter was signed that awoke his interest in nuclear energy. I thought I knew he was talking about nuclear energy. Of the 2,000 scientists there, I felt he was talking to me.
Some people consider Edward Teller as a clear example of a mad scientist. Many critics believe that Stanley Kubrick was inspired by Edward Teller to create the notorious character Dr. Strangelove.
The report, my conclusion, was that this idea was not a practical deterrent, for reasons which at this moment must be all too obvious.
Then you mean it is possible for them to have built such a thing?
Mr. President, the technology required is easily within the means of even the smallest nuclear power. It requires only the will to do so.
After the TNT explosion test, it was eventually decided that the first bomb should go off in Alamogordo, which is located 230 miles south of New Mexico in Los Alamos. The operation was codenamed Trinity. The codename comes from the belief in the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in Christianity. They were planning to launch the largest massacre of human beings in the name of Jesus. This 21-ton bomb was 200 times stronger than the calibration test. The light was so intense that could immediately cause blindness. It was visible within the radius of 16 kilometers. It melted the sands in the desert and turned them into green crystals. The radioactive effects remained in the region for 50 years. Before the bomb was tested, two other bombs named Little Boy and Fat Man were secretly taken to Oceania to be prepared for an attack on two Japanese cities. It was 8:15 a.m. local time on August 6, 1945. The first bomb, Little Boy, was dropped on Hiroshima by a bomber named Enola Gay. For the bomber to have enough time to flee the explosion, they dropped the bomb via a parachute. To make the detonation stronger, the bomb was set to go off 576 meters above the ground. Those who saw Little Boy explode mid-air from a distance said they saw a new sun in the sky. After the blast, two-thirds of the buildings in Hiroshima, including steelmaking and industrial factories, were completely destroyed. The only thing that was left standing in the city was the Hiroshima Prefectural Industrial Promotion Hall. The explosion happened on top of the building's dome, and as it was within the central focus of the blast, it was not completely devastated. The moment the bomb went off, about 100,000 residents in Hiroshima died on the spot. While Japan was in shock and the Japanese people had almost realized that they were defeated, then U.S. President Harry Truman announced that this bomb was just a warning. 3 days later, another bomb was detonated in Nagasaki, which claimed the lives of 40,000 people in that city. Next day, Japan conceded defeat and surrendered to U.S. conditions to end the war. In the following years, more people succumbed to injuries sustained after the explosion due to radiation. Even though the U.S. honored its forces who were involved in the Manhattan Project and the agents in the carnage were awarded, the events pushed the public to rise up against nuclear weapons. The harms caused by the newly invented elements were not always sudden and tangible like atomic bombs. The start of nuclear war dated back to 50 years before, when radioactive material was first discovered. In the spring of 1896, Marie Curie and her husband, Pierre Curie, discovered the amazing characteristics of some mineral stones, including uranium. They realized that the elements in the stones emit radiations that are not visible but pass through many barriers. The radiation was named gamma. After her husband's death, Marie Curie continued her research in 1910. It led to the discovery of radium as a new radioactive element.
Madame Curie.
The discovery made her the first woman to receive the Nobel Prize twice. But the award cost Marie Curie a lot. Many doctors say she was a victim of radioactive material, especially radium, during her experiments in the lab. The possibility was raised in the following years because back then, nuclear scientists did not know anything about the harmful effects of nuclear material. It caused bigger catastrophe. The discovery of radium among natural radioactive elements with the half-life of about 1,600 years left everyone in astonishment. The element's strange radiation added new color to advertisement in the West. Since the damage caused by the element and its radiation hadn't come to light yet, opportunistic traders sought to fulfill people's demands with these elements. They claimed that this dangerous material can help him live longer and healthier, so they introduced it to people's daily lives. They were used in the most sensitive cosmetic and hygienic products, including body lotions, lipsticks, toothpaste, and even water, bread, and chocolate. They claimed that radium as an ingredient in products is considered something positive. On the other hand, in 1917, the United States had just been involved in World War I. The Army needed clocks whose hands were luminous at night in the dark. So factories across the U.S. took up the job and started producing clocks. To paint the tiny impact numbers on the clock's screen, they instructed female workers to press the tip of the brush with their lips in order to keep it tiny. They were told that working with radium paint was not hazardous. After a while, some of the workers were diagnosed with strange diseases. They would go to the dentist to pull their decayed teeth, but not only wouldn't they be cured, their teeth would get injured. Things gradually got worse. After dentists touched their jaws, they would get injured. Many of them had cancerous tumors in their bones, and they would easily break. The first person who died was a 25-year-old woman named Amelia Maja, nicknamed Molly. She succumbed to the disease in less than a year. The doctors didn't have an answer to her mysterious death. Gradually, as more and more female workers came down with illness, they pieced together the puzzle and found out that radium was the reason behind the deadly disease. Although, after 5 or 6 years in the mid-30s, advertising products that contained radioactive element and using them in products were altogether banned, their effects continued to last. After the atomic bombing in the World War, the Radium Girls and similar incidents like the Chernobyl disaster in Ukraine in 1986 and the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster in 2011 after the 8.9 strong earthquake, the international community rose up against nuclear energy. But the question is, why do countries, even Japan that was subject to the biggest atomic curse, not give up nuclear energy? Why does a country like Iran make so much effort and spend so much money to achieve such an apparently dangerous energy? West Asia is known for its wars. The wars were initially waged under different excuses, but they usually pursue the same goal, and that is oil. The United States' latest direct war in the region was launched in 2003. The U.S. invaded Iraq under the pretext that the country possessed weapons of mass destruction, like biological and nuclear bombs. But after years of war and bloodshed, no weapons that were used as a pretext to invade the country were found. Even though no unconventional weapons were found in the country, it was rich in oil resources that was hugely extracted. After the invasion, oil was extracted and used to push U.S. policies and economy forward. The U.S. dealt with Iraq and raised accusations that are somehow similar to Israel's behavior vis-a-vis Iran.
That Iran has another secret facility in Tehran, a secret atomic warehouse for storing massive amounts of equipment and material from Iran's secret nuclear weapons program. We exposed the site of Iran's secret atomic archive. It's right here, in the Shorabad district of Tehran. Today, I'm revealing the site of a second facility, Iran's secret atomic warehouse. It's right here, in the Turkuzabad district of Tehran, just 3 miles away.
The Turkuzabad carpet washing center was Netanyahu's last trick for the media to get the international community on board his Iranophobia scheme for, quote, possessing nuclear weapons. But the Israeli regime did not stop there at the media campaign level. To date, it has assassinated top Iranian nuclear scientists. He's someone who doesn't want to realize that based on numerous inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, and the religious views of the Iranian leader, it is not after nuclear weapons.
As of today, I can state that Iran is implementing its nuclear-related commitments. We have had access to all the sites and locations which we needed to visit.
So why does Israel keep insisting on the accusation and pursue such confrontational policies with Iran to stop the country from reaching nuclear technology? Is it possible that the objections are just excuses? Just like what happened in Iraq? How can the energy benefit Iran that the Israeli regime does everything it can to stop it from reaching the technology?
It was exactly 6 years after the first and last nuclear bomb blast that a national lab in Idaho was lit up by only 4 200-watt light bulbs. Even though the EBR-1 project's goal was not to generate electricity, it corroborated theories concerning producing electricity from nuclear energy. The system, which was more complicated than making an atomic bomb, was later named nuclear reactor. The reactors could easily provide electricity for a city or more without constructing huge dams or consuming thousands of tons of charcoal and emitting pollutant gases. 70 years after the 4 famous light bulbs in Idaho were lit up, a little further away, Bill Gates, as the richest man on the planet and the owner of Microsoft, was investing on nuclear reactors that could work for 60 years after fueling just once. Today, reactors have considerably reduced consumption of oil condensates for producing energy. For example, the 1,000-megawatt reactor in Iran's Bushehr has saved 47 million barrels of oil that would otherwise be used for generating electricity in 7 years. In Europe, generating electricity is the foremost goal of using nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, but in Asia, there is a more burning issue, and that is water. West Asia is among the driest regions in the continent. It has only 1% of fresh water resources in the world. Many analysts believe that the next wars in the region will not be over oil. They say water is a serious concern in this part of the world. In this dry region, Israel has managed to export its agricultural products to all across the world, besides meeting 95% of its population's demands. The Israeli regime does not have underground water resources or many rivers. However, it has tipped environmental balance in its own favor by using nuclear technology to rein in nature. On the shores of the Red Sea, the saline water is desalinated for agriculture and drinking. As an example, Sorek, as the largest water treatment plant in the world, located 15 kilometers south of Tel Aviv, can purify 230 million cubic meters of water and tackle water shortage to a great extent. This amount of water is equal to the water Iran annually receives from the Karajan Latian dams for drinking and agriculture in Tehran and Elbourz provinces, with a population of about 15 million people. Even though only 20% of the land occupied by the Israeli regime is arable, today it has become an agricultural hub.
This is the finished product, desalinated water. And according to the officials here at the plant, it's a more complete water than water that hasn't had the saline removed, because in the process of desalination, minerals are added back.
It seems the Israeli regime and Washington are seeking to stop Iran from accessing nuclear energy, not because they are worried it might make a nuclear bomb, but they are concerned that Iran might achieve the nuclear technology that can strengthen its independence and tackle millions of Iranians' needs. Water and energy are among the most vital necessities in agriculture and other industries, and even if a country like Iran does not need nuclear energy to fulfill its needs, it still cannot forego the energy. If the fruit produced by farmers goes bad before reaching the market, it will bring nothing but financial loss and physical exhaustion. Many kinds of fruit cannot resist against natural bacteria and fungus as they quickly go bad. Today, the key to reach the market especially the international one, is in the hand of irradiation. Thanks to nuclear technology, radiation technology has been around for 60 years and is used in the agriculture industry. Exposing fruits to the light emission of radiation for a short time can destroy the larvae and bacteria in fruits and increase its shelf life. Today, many agricultural products and even fruits like strawberry that have very short shelf life are exported to other countries. Exposing fruits to the gamma ray at entry points and quarantine centers of a country can stop the spread of insects and pests.
We have to look at the taste, the color, the granulometry, is there some foreign material, and also we look at the microbiology. Spices can be contaminated up to 1 million bacteria per gram. And with the irradiation, it can reduce by 99.9%. Other treatment will not offer that kind of reduction. Irradiation for us will not change the taste, the color, will not leave any residue, and also is really lowering the microbiological count.
When we piece together different problems like medical treatment, industrial experiments, and other issues a country can resolve by using the nuclear technology, we find out that there is a good reason behind Iran's political and economic battle to achieve the technology. Today, if a country wants to guarantee its economic, scientific, and technological future, it needs to step in this field.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
In the United States, Meta's president of global affairs, Nick Clegg, has said he has to decide on Donald Trump's possible 2023 return to Instagram and Facebook. Please stay with us for more on this story. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. Nick Clegg, Meta's president of global affairs, is charged with deciding whether former US President Donald Trump will be allowed to return to Facebook and Instagram in 2023, Nick Clegg confirmed on Thursday, 22nd of September. Speaking at an event held in Washington by news organization Semaphore, Nick Clegg said The company was seriously debating whether Donald Trump's accounts should be reinstated and said it was a decision that I oversee and I drive. Clegg added that while he will be making the final call, he will consult the chief executive officer of Meta, Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook board of directors and outside experts. It is not a capricious decision, he said. We will look at the signals related to the real-world harm to make a decision whether, at the 2-year point, which is early January next year, whether Donald Trump gets reinstated to the platform. The former president was suspended from a number of online platforms, including those owned by Meta, following the 6th of January 2021 Capitol riot, during which Donald Trump used his social media accounts to praise and perpetuate the violence. While Twitter banned Donald Trump permanently, Meta suspended Trump's account for 2 years, to be later re-evaluated. In May of 2021, a temporary ban was upheld by Facebook's Oversight Board, a group of appointed academics and former politicians meant to operate independently of Facebook's corporate leadership. However, the board returned a final decision on Trump's accounts to Meta, suggesting the company decide in 6 months' time whether to make the ban permanent. Nick Clegg said that that decision will be made on 7th of January 2023. Nick Clegg previously served as Britain's Deputy Prime Minister and joined Facebook as Vice President for Global Affairs and Communications in 2018. In February of this year, he was promoted to the top company policy executive role. The website Gizmodo.com has more on this story. Donald Trump could be back to his old social media antiques in just a few months. The 2-year ban barring the former president from Facebook expires at the beginning of 2023. And Meta, Facebook's parent company, hasn't revealed whether it will be extending Donald Trump's virtual exile. When you make a decision that affects the public realm, you need to act with great caution, Nick Clegg, Meta's president of global affairs, said during a media event hosted by the news organization Semaphore. It seems that Nick Clegg is the one who will ultimately be tasked with deciding, one way or the other, the fate of Donald Trump's Facebook presence. The executive further explained that to determine the company's future course of action, Meta would consult with outside sources and assess the risk of real-world harm, all of which echoes previous company statements. The former president, Donald Trump, was kicked off of Meta platforms, Facebook and Instagram, the day after 6th of January 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, for his role in inciting the violent riots on that day. Initially, the chief executive officer, Mark Zuckerberg, announced the block would last indefinitely. However, Meta's oversight board contested that decision and mandated that a timeline for re-evaluation will be imposed. In June of 2021, the company complied with the board's request and declared that at the end of 2 years, it would look to experts to assess whether the risk to public safety has receded. In the wake of 6th of January 2021, YouTube also instituted a ban on Donald Trump, and so did Twitter, where the former president seemed to spend the bulk of his online time. Notably, in contrast to Meta, Twitter's ban is permanent. After the technology giant announced their prohibition on Donald Trump, he responded with a lawsuit, and then he created Truth Social, his own free speech platform. Donald Trump has been widely criticized for his rabid social media use while in office. Often his tweets and posts propagated disinformation. However, for Nick Clegg and Meta, the accuracy or inaccuracy of Donald Trump's posts isn't the issue, so much as the potential impact of those posts. If we think there is content on our platform which will lead to real-world harm, that is, physical harm, then we feel we have a clear responsibility to act against it, Nick Clegg reiterated on Thursday. If Donald Trump is allowed back on Facebook and Instagram, it would grant him access to a much larger social media audience in time for the 2024 presidential election. The website Politico has also covered this story. Meta's top policy executive, Nick Clegg, will be the one to decide whether to reinstate former President Donald Trump's account in January of 2023, he said on Thursday, 22nd of September. Nick Clegg, Meta's president of global affairs, said whether to extend Donald Trump's two-year suspension is a decision that I oversee and I drive. He said that at an event held in Washington by Semaphore, a news organization. It is not a capricious decision, he said. We will look at the signals related to the real-world harm to make a decision whether at the two-year point, which is in early January next year, whether Donald Trump gets reinstated to the platform. Nick Clegg added that he would consult with Chief Executive Officer Mark Zuckerberg and Meta's board of directors. He said Zuckerberg is focused on building the virtual metaverse, while Nick Clegg is responsible for the implementation and enforcement of broad policy issues. Nick Clegg gave no indication which way he plans to decide, but said he will make that decision on 7th of January 2023.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The Al-Shabaab terrorist group has wreaked havoc on Somalia for over a decade now. The Somalian government has failed to dismantle the ever-expanding tentacles of this Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group, which continues to increase its attacks across Somalia and especially in the capital, Mogadishu. Recently, Al-Shabaab terrorists carried out a devastating 30-hour siege at a hotel in Somalia's capital, leaving over 20 dead. A survivor of this horrific incident speaks of what transpired.
People fled in confusion. They were all running towards the place they thought they would be safe. The hotel began to fill with smoke and flames, and I immediately saw one of the hotel bodyguards bleeding and another man wounded.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. In the first part of our program today, we are focusing on an upsurge of terrorist attacks in Somalia, despite claims by the United States that it is actively combating the Al-Shabaab terrorists in this country. We are asking, what exactly is the U.S. military doing in Somalia? The second part of our show is on plans by Algeria, Niger, and Nigeria to revive a decades-old project to pipe gas across the Sahara to Europe. We are asking, will the project take off this time, or is it just a pipe dream? So stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analysis on today's subject.
Somalia's war on terror. Somalia, a country plagued by violence for over three decades, has recently seen an upsurge of attacks by Al-Shabaab terrorist group. This has prompted President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed to issue a statement following the attack by this terrorist group that left over 20 people dead inside a hotel in Mogadishu. The Somalian president declared that Al-Shabaab is like a deadly snake in your clothes. There is no solution but to kill it before it kills you.
He also stated that he will do everything possible to weaken the terrorists who already control much of the rural areas in central and southern Somalia. Now, to discuss the upsurge in attacks by Al-Shabaab terrorists in Somalia, we contacted Mohamed Gebode, an investigative journalist, and we first asked Mr. Gebode to tell us the reason behind the apparent upsurge in attacks by Al-Shabaab terrorists in Somalia.
The increased level of insurgent attacks across Somalia can be attributed to a number of reasons, but the main reason being is that we have a new elected president in Somalia by the name of Hassan Sheikh Mohamud. Hassan Sheikh Mohamud has been in office for 4 months, and he's already following in the footsteps of his predecessors in regards to Western counterterrorism policies. He's already been on a whirlwind tour, traveling all over the globe from countries like Uganda to Turkey, trying to gain support and vowing to eradicate the insurgents. But unfortunately, his administration does not have a solid game plan. And this can be attributed to why the insurgents in Somalia are hitting harder and harder than ever before.
The president of Somalia has said that he will do everything possible to weaken the Al-Shabaab. Some of the measures include reforming the security forces.
Yes, ups and downs were always there, but they are in a better position now. We have at least a part of the security forces well-reformed, integrated.
Now, can the new president of Somalia weaken the Al-Shabaab and retake areas controlled by these Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group?
Regarding whether the Somali government can take back territory now or not from the insurgents, I honestly think anything is possible, but it depends on how they go about it. If they implement local initiatives and empower local communities, I honestly think they'll get results. But if they stay on their current trajectory, which is following the Western counterterrorism policies, it won't bear any results. We've seen this happen in the past. Consecutive Somali governments following the calls of the West, war on terror, night raids and drone strikes, and are yet to actually get any results and actually turn the community against them. But by empowering the local community, you have a chance of not just winning the hearts and minds, but also turning large segments of the population against insurgents. The battle against insurgents is not always the barrel of the gun. It's also challenging them ideologically.
The United States has a military presence in Somalia to ostensibly target Al-Shabaab terrorists. Yet this terror group continues its reign of terror in this Horn of Africa state and beyond. The presence of U.S. troops in Somalia raises suspicion amid long-term concerns that Washington is pursuing ulterior motives in this strategic Horn of Africa state.
The United States has had a military presence in Somalia for a long time, spanning all the way back to the Cold War, but now it's intensified over the past two decades since the launch of the global war on terror. In regards to what they're doing in Somalia today, if you ask the average, analyst or expert, they'll tell you, oh yes, they're here to combat terrorists or combat insurgency. But in reality, the war on terror is nothing more than a Trojan horse. Somalia is a strategically located country. The United States has geopolitical and resource interests in this country. And the fight against insurgents under the guise of the war on terror is being exploited by the United States, but not just the United States, but its fellow allies, nations, neighboring states, Gulf monarchies, and even other Western countries. So the war on terror and the long-term U.S. military presence, I would say, is a Trojan horse to secure U.S. geopolitical interest in Somalia.
The United Nations says drought is likely to push parts of Somalia into famine by the end of the year. UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Somalia, Adam Abdel Mulla, elaborates here on the current drought situation in this country.
The current unprecedented drought that is a result of four consecutive failed rainy seasons, with the fifth and the sixth projected to also be below average, is causing acute food insecurity. As we speak, 7.1 million Somalis are acutely food insecure. Among them, 1.5 million children below the age of 5 are acutely malnourished. Within this category, there are 365,000 who are severely malnourished and may not make it by the end of October this year.
Al-Shabaab terrorists have been attacking convoys delivering aid to needy communities. Why is this Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group targeting humanitarian aid?
With Somalia currently going through its worst drought in 40 years, the humanitarian crisis is probably at a peak crisis point at the moment. In regards to insurgents targeting humanitarian aid, the insurgent group in Somalia bans UN agencies from operating in their area. So if we were to say a convoy of aid from the UN was traveling through a certain part of Somalia, there's a possibility that insurgents might face an encounter from the insurgents. But from to my knowledge and to many people that work in the humanitarian sector, the insurgent group have their own humanitarian coordination officer, which they oversee, and they the distribution of aid into areas they're control. But in many parts of southern and central Somalia, these are isolated towns, and the only way to access them is through air. So that's how the government and its allies are getting humanitarian aid into this area, since it's impossible to travel by land in most parts of the country, since it's controlled by the insurgent group.
The African Union peacekeeping mission in Somalia will operate in the country until the end of 2024. This mission has trained over 8,000 Somalian police officers since the first deployment in the country in 2009. A legal advisor to the presidency in Somalia says the country's security agencies will play a leading role ahead of the withdrawal of African peacekeeping forces.
Somalia has commenced the revision of the Somalia Transition Plan to ensure that our vision, strategic objectives, and priorities are aligned with the transnational nature of the threats that we face today. The revised Somali Transition Plan, along with the joint CONOPS, paves the way for the Somali security forces to lead more offensive operations built around agile, mobile, and resilient forces.
And my last question to Mr. Gebode. Will the Somalia government accomplish its mission of weakening Al-Shabaab and other terrorist groups while developing the security capacity of the Somali federal government?
With the withdrawal of African Union troops slated for 2024, honestly, I do believe that Somalia will be ready to handle its own security. That's if only Somalis are allowed to lead. The biggest security issue that Somalia has been facing over the past 15 years or two decades, it's because the security endeavors in the country have been led by outsiders. But if you allow Somalis to take the lead, I'm pretty sure they'll be more than capable of securing their country. And furthermore, the African Union troops have been in Somalia for 15 years, and their results have been very limited. So I honestly do believe that if the local Somali security forces are empowered, that they will be able to overtake security of their country.
Well, there you have it. If the local security agencies in Somalia are empowered, they will be able to take charge of the country's security. I'd like to thank our Somali affairs analyst, Mohamed Gebode, for his time. We shall keep an eye on Somalia and give you up-to-date analysis on the situation as it unfolds. Let's now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the proposed Trans-Sahara gas pipeline. Stay with us.
Trans-Sahara gas pipeline dream.
Algeria, Niger, and Nigeria recently held talks on the revival of a decades-old project to pipe gas across the Sahara, a potential opportunity for Europe to diversify its gas sources as Russia's military operation in Ukraine continues.
The route of Nigerian gas to North Africa has fueled many interests in the past, but the $13 billion project has been put on hold in the past due to security concerns in the Sahel region.
Energy and petroleum ministers from Algeria, Niger, and Nigeria have already met in Algiers in a bid to ensure the 4,000-kilometer Trans-Sahara gas pipeline takes off in time. Let's listen to their remarks after the Algiers meeting.
The meeting we had today in Algiers is really important for a strategic project, which is the Trans-Saharan gas pipeline through Nigeria, Niger, and Algeria.
We believe that the time for this project has come. For the energy security of Africa, and also for the additional monetization of our gas resources.
We are very optimistic about the progress of the project. The task force was set up and it will ensure that we move quickly towards the review of the feasibility study.
Now, for more on this Trans-Sahara Gas Pipeline project, we contacted Mr. Abayomi Azikiwe. He's the editor for the Pan-African News, Awaya. Nigeria, Algeria, and Niger are renewing efforts to implement the decades-old Trans-Sahara gas pipeline as Europe struggles to replace Russian gas. Now, do these countries have enough political will and funding for the project?
Well, that's up to the European Union countries that are interested in expanding their overseas natural gas imports. It's going to take a lot of foreign investments in order for these countries to expand. Algeria, we know, the French president visited there several weeks ago, yet they are going to need external investment as well in order to meet growing demands from Europe.
Over the past months, humanitarian organizations have repeatedly warned of deteriorating security across three countries of the Central Sahel, namely Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger. Violence has its epicenter in the so-called tri-border area between Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, and is spreading fast. Nigeria is also experiencing insecurity, which has impacted negatively on development, especially in the northern parts of the country. The Nigerian government is working tirelessly to restore security in this country. Nigeria's National Security Advisor says they are working on a new strategy to eradicate violence.
The members of the armed forces have also made a commitment that in the coming weeks, they've already started working on a new strategy to deal with these snippets of violence. And they've given their word, their commitment to the president, that there will be a change in momentum.
Experts say the worsening security situation in the Sahel region, particularly in Nigeria and Niger, could mean that the pipeline remains a pipe dream. Now, do you agree?
In West Africa, there is definitely a security question that is very, very important right now in countries like Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso, and even areas of Togo, as well as Nigeria. They have had attacks by insurgent organizations, rebel organizations, which have killed civilians, which have dislocated people from their home areas. So it will take a lot of security considerations in order to expand the pipelines in regard to construction and other issues in order for it to be secure in regard to exporting natural gas to European Union countries.
Despite Nigeria's massive wealth in terms of gas and petroleum, its population suffers from poverty and insecurity. Niger, also a landlocked sub-Saharan African nation, has the world's fourth largest uranium reserves, around 7% of the global total.
Yet, Niger remains one of the poorest countries in the world. Interestingly, the wealth of these countries is extracted by Western multinationals that continue to pillage Africa, leaving most of the people languishing in poverty. There is still doubt if the project will be a game changer for the people in this region.
That would depend on the delicate balance of political forces inside of Nigeria. They inherited a colonial system, which is inherently unstable. And, of course, they'll have to reconfigure their governmental apparatus in order to deal with the internal contradictions that exist in Nigeria. But it depends on the people inside the country and the governments they select whether or not the resources from oil as well as natural gas and agricultural exports as well is channeled back to the people to meet their basic needs.
There is another coastal pipeline proposed through many West African countries to Morocco and onto Europe. The construction of the Nigeria-Morocco gas pipeline is underway. The Nigeria-Morocco pipeline would be the longest gas pipeline in the world. It will be 7,000 kilometers long and link 15 countries economically. Finally, the gas will be transported from Morocco to Spain. Nigeria's Minister of State for Petroleum speaks here on the gas pipeline projects being pursued by his country.
We're in the process of building a pipeline, a gas pipeline from here to Algeria, targeting the European market. We are also building a pipeline from the West African gas pipeline to Morocco, also targeting Europe. So what the Russian and Ukraine crisis has created is additional market for our gas.
Now, is it economical for the Nigeria-Morocco gas pipeline to run simultaneously with the Trans-Sahara gas pipeline?
Well, it depends on the level of demand for natural gas, which is accelerating. And also, it relates to the question you asked earlier about the security situations and considerations in West Africa. They do have the capacity, the resources are there, but it depends upon the level of investment for the construction of infrastructure and also for the security of the pipelines during the construction, as well as the operation of taking the oil from these countries and exporting it to the European Union states.
Now, the EU plans to reduce its carbon footprint by at least 55% by 2030, beginning with phasing out coal and oil, but also cutting natural gas use. Now, should African countries involved in these gas projects be concerned that Europe might make an about turn and withdraw from the gas project when they find other alternatives?
I don't think that's going to happen in the short term. Right now, with the war going on in Ukraine, there's an immediate energy crisis that's impacting particularly the European Union countries. They're going to have to resolve that over the next few years before they consider any viable alternatives to natural gas, particularly in regard to heating.
Well, Western countries in their classic double standards have abandoned the call for immediate transition to clean energy because implementing such a policy at this juncture is to their disadvantage. I would like to thank Bayomi Azikiwe, editor for the Pan-African Newswire, for his incisive analysis today. And that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Send us your comments through our social media handle, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
For 4 years, former President Donald J. Trump treated the federal government and the political apparatus operating in his name as an extension of his private real estate company. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalist Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled, Another Trump Mystery, Why Did He Resist Returning to Government?